Good afternoon and welcome to the state's use of technology to support older rural adults aging in place, Spotlight on Arizona webinar. Today we will begin with a few logistics. Please note all lines will be muted. To ask a question or make a comment, please use the chat box. If you are in full screen mode, you may need to minimize the screen to see the chat box. Please complete the evaluation in the pop-up box after the webinar to help improve your experience. Thank you. I will now turn the slides over to Jody Mann, Project Director at NASHBE.
Hi, good afternoon and welcome. This is Jody Manns with NASHBE. We'll just quickly go through the agenda for the day. We'll start with a very quick introduction just to give you a little bit of background as to what you can expect to hear. We'll go through three presenters that will talk about different aspects of Arizona's models, including a value-based payment model, a ride-sharing model, as well as their approach to electronic visit verification. We'll have a short period of time for questions that can be asked via the chat box. Then we'll do a quick wrap-up and evaluation. So just to set the stage a bit, we do have a couple of issues that led NASHBE to create a toolkit to help states as they address our aging populations, particularly in rural parts of state. And those issues are really twofold, but together they create lots of opportunities for states to make advances, particularly in payments and Medicaid programs. One is that we have a rapidly aging population in the United States. Currently, we have over 46 million adults in America who are over the age of 65. And within the next decade, the youngest group of the baby boom generation will reach age 65, which is going to increase that total by nearly 18 million. Once that happens, by 2030, 20% of Americans will be aged 65 years or over. At the same time, the rural populations in America are currently older than urban populations, with older adults representing a disproportionate share of rural populations. And as of 2010, so as of the last census tract, 25% of Americans aged 65 and older were living in rural areas. Next slide. This is just a visual that I thought was very telling that we pulled from the Rural Health Information Hub that shows by county where folks are over the age of 65. And again, this is from 2010. So these numbers may be looking a little bit different soon, but you can see that there are certainly pockets in virtually all states, and most of them, at least when I look at my state, are particularly rural areas. So this gives us kind of a visual to understand the rural populations that we're focusing on. Next slide. So NASHBE did put together a toolkit looking at various states, and we'll go through those in just a moment, and found some themes and areas of opportunity as we access authority in our states to support policy change. And there really were three areas of opportunities, and you're going to hear about pieces of all of those today, including increasing workforce and training opportunities, providing facilitation for access to services, and, of course, addressing social determinants of health. And states have a multitude of ways to do these things. There is always the legislative and budget lever that states can be pushing to establish programs and, of course, find the funding to support those. Regulation for licensed providers and facilities, as well as the accompanying guidance that often goes along with that. Managed care contracts, as well as system partnerships, are a good lever that many states have utilized. And then finally, 1115 Medicaid waivers, as states are looking to demonstrate programs. So today we're going to focus on Arizona. The toolkit that NASHBE created highlights initiatives from a diverse cohort of states, folks from Alaska, Arizona, Georgia, Idaho, Minnesota, New Mexico, Tennessee, and Washington. We're all a part of this toolkit. Today, we decided to look specifically at Arizona to take a deeper dive into a range of very interesting programs and policies designed to support older adults in rural areas. So at this point, I would like to turn it over to Arizona. I'm going to turn it over to Matthew Isiagu, who is the Assistant Director in the Division of Healthcare Management at the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System. Matthew?
Thank you. So I'm going to talk a little bit right now about some of our value-based purchasing, or VBP, initiatives that specifically support older and rural adults that are aging in place. The next slide, the value-based payments slide. So some additional context. So Arizona Medicaid, the vast majority of the program is operated under an 1115 demonstration waiver, and we operate an integrated managed care state. So that means both integrated physical and behavioral health services for most programs, and then also for our Arizona Long-Term Care System, or ALTEX program, also integration of the LTSS services. So given our managed care focus, under the umbrella of value-based payment initiatives, there are three main areas. So I'll discuss the top two at a high level and get into some more detail on the third one. But the first one is the APM, or alternative payment model, for performance-based payments, or PBP. So these are incentive arrangements that involve MCOs contracting with providers to achieve quality outcomes. The second initiative is an APM withhold and quality measure performance incentive. And so this rewards MCOs who achieve quality outcomes. And then the third are differential adjusted payments. So these are operated as directed payments, and these are specifically for providers achieving quality outcomes. Next slide, performance-based payments. So these are incentive arrangements that the MCO is responsible for entering into contracts with providers under the APM Learning Action Network, or APM LAN framework. So I've shown a visual there of the four main categories, so kind of a spectrum or a continuum. From left to right, increasing accountability at the provider level to achieve outcomes. And one of the ways that we're able to handle this contractually is to require our Arizona Long-Term Care System, or ALTEX, Elderly and Physically Disabled, or EPD program, to contract a certain percentage of their payments each year. Under the frameworks and really under any of the frameworks starting in 2B or higher. So as you can see here, for contract year ending, or CYE 18, the requirement was 35% of all payments under the APM LAN framework, 2B or higher, and that's moved up progressively to 50% last year, 60% this year, and we are targeting 70% next year. Next slide. For quality performance measures, or QPM. So instead of being handled at the provider level, all of these are really measured at the managed care organization or health plan level. So to be able to compete in this, the MCOs are required to have met the PBP, or performance-based payment percentage thresholds that I mentioned in the contract on the last slide. So the way that this is funded is a 1% capitation withhold from MCO capitation, and they have the ability to earn back those dollars on the basis of meeting their quality performance measures. So I've shown here for the current contract year for ALTEX EPD, the QPMs and the minimum performance standards are shown there. I've provided some of the details, and they include things like ambulatory care, ED utilization rates, plan all-cause readmissions, and a couple of population-specific items, in this case diabetes, monitoring of persistent medications, and heart failure admission rates. Next slide, differential adjusted payments. So differential adjusted payments are a little bit different in that they focus at the provider level. So on the past two, I explain some of the ways that we're able to really leverage our managed care framework, especially for that ALTEX EPD population, to focus on achieving quality outcomes for our older and disabled populations. So the differential adjusted payments allow us to target at an even more refined level some of the specific quality outcomes that we're looking for from providers. So the way that this is implemented, as I mentioned, are directed payments. Both a state plan amendment and then a 438.6C preprint So that's under the managed care regulations. So those are the two mechanisms for approval. And these represent an overall positive adjustment to fee schedule rates that the providers otherwise would have been reimbursed. And this allows us to provide an alternative and higher fee schedule for certain providers that have committed to supporting designated actions that improve patients' care experience, improve members' health, and reduce the cost of care growth. All of these are looked at on an annual basis, and we implement each program on a one-year time-limited increase, only for providers that meet specific criteria. Next slide is a brief overview of the current year's DAP initiatives. So we actually have 19 separate differential adjusted payment or DAP initiatives that span almost all of our provider types. So the targeted increases, those range from 0.5% to up to 40% on select services. And some of our specific initiatives that support technology and the ways that we can use technology to support older and rural adults that receive services through our programs include the promotion of health information exchange or HIE activities, also including an HIE program that is focused on ensuring the financial viability of critical access hospitals or CAHS, as well as some specific quality measures that measure outcomes for our older members in nursing facilities. And finally, a unique program that we implemented just this year to incentivize home and community-based services providers to participate in our electronic visit verification or EVV planning efforts. On each of these slides, I've provided a link toward the bottom that will take you to the relevant policy, or in this case, the relevant public notice. Next slide, health information exchange. So this is one of the areas that our agency has chose to really focus on, is providing some additional financial resources to incentivize specific activities for, in this case, hospitals to participate in the health information exchange. So the specific criteria that needed to be met in this case were the hospital actually transferring the admission, discharge, and transfer, or ADT, information to the statewide exchange, the submission of patient identifiable immunization data, and completing a data quality profile. So one of the classes of hospitals that we specifically targeted with this initiative are the critical access hospitals. So critical access hospitals are federally defined as those that are 35 miles from another hospital that provide 24/7 emergency care and are on the smaller side, so have less than 25 acute inpatient beds and less than 96 hours average length of stay. So for those critical access hospitals in the state that met the HIE criteria, so demonstrating that they are a really key provider in a rural area and that we've been able to connect them to technology that is going to allow them to better serve our members accessing those services in a rural area, the qualification here was for an 8% increase on all of their inpatient and outpatient services. So this level of increase, the magnitude of increase, is on the higher end of the initiatives that we've implemented, and in this case, it was really to highlight the importance of these providers and getting them connected in order to be able to serve our vulnerable members in those rural areas. Next slide is on nursing facility quality outcomes. A different approach here, so using the same mechanism of the differential adjusted payment, but instead of measuring the participation activities in a health information exchange, in this case, it's the achievement of specific quality outcomes. So there are two aspects to this payment, and nursing facility is able to qualify for one, both, or none of these two. So the first is pressure ulcer performance measure. Qualifying for that is a 1% rate increase. The second is a urinary tract infection performance measure, and that's also an additional 1 percentage point increase. So up to 2 percentage points nursing facilities are able to earn. And in each of these cases, the qualification was to be less than or equal to the statewide Arizona average percentage for each of those measures. So in this case, being lower than the statewide average is a good thing. And this represents our attempt as an agency to move that overall statewide average in leveraging our Medicaid participating nursing facilities on these specific measures. In both of these cases, the measures are based on publicly available data through the Medicare Nursing Home Compare website. So it's, in that sense, it's independently produced and validated, published, and accessible to everyone. And these two initiatives in particular, they were developed in partnership with providers and stakeholders. Next and final slide is on the electronic visit verification or EVV provider survey. So in this case, the provider group targeted were home and community-based based services providers, especially those that we know are providing services that are going to be tracked under the electronic visit verification program and system. And they had the opportunity to earn a 1 percentage point increase on all of their paid claims. And to do that, all they had to do was to participate in an EVV provider readiness survey. So this survey was a level of engagement that we were able to bring to our providers to really assist us in gathering key data that was used to inform our development and implementation of our EVV system. So gathering information on current provider practices and technologies already implemented, their expected usage of the new system, and to get feedback from them on some different device and connectivity options that were being contemplated. Especially in this case, the differential adjusted payment, actually having some dollars on the line here, allowed us to incentivize provider participation at a much higher rate than would have otherwise been expected. And so as it shows another application of this differential adjusted payment mechanism to incentivize a specific action that in this case is going to support our overall EVV rollout and implementation that is going to be discussed later in this presentation. So in summary, I've tried to give a brief sketch of the different value-based purchasing initiatives that Arizona has implemented and given specific attention to our differential adjusted payment model that has allowed us to target some specific actions and outcomes to improve the quality of care and access to care for our older members in rural areas, and specifically highlighting that we've been able to implement that on one side in terms of incentivizing providers to participate in key activities, whether it's connecting to the HIE or participating in a provider survey, or on another end of the spectrum to really incentivize and reward actual quality outcomes as measured by Medicare. So I'm going to pause there and hand the next section of the presentation off to my colleague, Christina Quas.
Thank you. So on the first slide here, just to go over some background related to the non-emergency medical transportation rideshare provider type. So some background on Arizona. Our contracted MCOs are mandated to provide enrolled members non-emergency medical transportation services. The majority of our MCOs contract with a broker to supply the non-emergency medical transportation. And then you can see some data for federal fiscal year 2018, 13.7% of ACCESS members use NEMT, 2.8% of our total service spend, which was roughly $283 million of spend for federal fiscal year 2018. Next slide discusses assessing the need. So there were ongoing concerns related to capacity of NEMT providers, particularly during high volume months here in Arizona. Additionally, there was increased demand of non-emergency transportation due to expansion of opioid use disorder treatment. The specific populations served by the Medicaid program that would benefit from the additional curb-to-curb capacity, which would be the rideshare companies, and then additionally could help to provide additional resources for those members who maybe could not use the curb-to-curb benefit but would be more beneficial for them to use a door-to-door type service. So on the next slide, I discuss the rideshare model. We established a new provider type for rideshare providers. We call them transportation network companies, or TNCs. The provider type was effective May 1st of 2019. The TNC providers may, but is not deemed to own or operate or control a personal motor vehicle of the TNC driver. The TNC must meet the requirements of Arizona statute and issued a permit by the Arizona Department of Transportation pursuant to statute. Next slide. On the rideshare model, the TNCs are required to use a digital network or software application to connect members to transportation services provided by the drivers. The TNCs must provide services to members and bill through an NEMT broker who already holds a contract with one of our MCOs. Member rides coordinated through the NEMT broker, so not directly through the TNC, but through the broker. Information provided to the TNC driver is limited to the member's first name and contains a mask, phone number, and then also includes the pickup and drop-off address for the member. Next slide. The TNC provider is required to maintain all driver's records, including criminal background, tax, federal health care program exclusion information, vehicle inspection reports, service logs, trip logs, and any enforcement actions. Next and final slide. The rideshare model, when it was set up, reduce the training requirements for TNC providers in comparison to the standard NEMT transportation provider type. In addition, or as a result of that, they also have a reduced rate of reimbursement. So the base rate, 60.3% for urban NEMT and 60.3% for rural. And then the mileage rate you can see here, 52.3 for urban and 60.3 of the rural miles based upon the standard NEMT rates that are set. We have more information available on our website regarding the rates set forth and the requirements of our TNC providers. And like I mentioned, maybe not all of the aging adult population would be in the bucket of individuals to benefit from the curb-to-curb model and may need the more door-to-door model where the driver gives them more assistance. We are believing that adding the rideshare model would open up more of the standard NEMT transportation providers to be able to provide that service as well. And that concludes my presentation. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Sarah Johnston, to discuss the EVV.
Hi, I'm Sarah Johnston. I'm a program development officer here at ACCESS, Arizona's Medicaid program. And just level setting, providing a little bit of background just in case folks aren't aware of what EVV is, but it's a federal mandate for Section 1903 of the Social Security Act, you may know it as the 21st Century Cures Act, requires electronic verification of personal care and home health services. In Arizona, this spans across all lines of business, including our long-term care population, but not entirely. Also, this spans across physical health care services and behavioral health care services. And so essentially, EVV is an electronic means of having a caregiver going into the home of a member or serving the member in a community setting to clock in and clock out of the services they provide. And an EVV system is required to verify the following items: the type of service performed, the individual receiving and providing the service, the date and time the service begins and ends, and the location of the service. So we're planning on implementing EVV within the first half of next calendar year 2020. Arizona is utilizing an open vendor model. This means that we have chosen one statewide EVV contractor that was procured by our program, and we have chosen Sendata Technologies. But under this model, we do allow providers to continue to use existing systems and or choose an alternate system that they would like to use, as long as it meets general requirements and Arizona-specific requirements to send data to an aggregator so we have state-level data. And one reason why we chose that model is specific to our unique strategy around EVV. Certainly, we want to comply with EVV, but we also want to make sure that EVV helps make sure that members get the services when they need them. And so we are proposing to use EVV to help mitigate and track access to care issues by providing data to help us monitor both network adequacy as well as inform workforce development planning. So we're actually calling EVV an access to care initiative. So when individuals receive a service initially, whether they're an existing member or whether they're a newly enrolled member, we are going to measure and track when that service was initiated from the time that the authorization was provided. So in that vein, we're requiring all EVV services to have an authorization from the health plan. That includes the date of assessment that was used to determine medical necessity for the service. And then we will track the authorization and the assessment date to the date of when the service was provided, and we have specific timelines for existing members getting a new service or newly enrolled members getting a new service. And then we can track to see potentially where there may be network adequacy issues, for example, if it's taking a long time to get a service from the point of authorization to actually being initiated. We'll be able to look at that. And that's certainly particularly helpful in our rural communities to look at and measuring network adequacy. Other access to care that we're tackling with EVV would be gaps in care. And our process is still in the planning phase, but essentially providers will enter a plan of care in the EVV system, including what services and tasks will be performed. Then following that, a schedule will be entered for the direct care worker or the caregiver based upon the plan of care. As part of this process as well, providers will be talking with members about contingency planning for if the care isn't provided as scheduled, what kinds of preferences would a member have to get that care either provided that day, the next time it's scheduled, or within 2 hours if it's something that's of a critical nature to ensure that we don't have any adverse events as it pertains to their health care. Regarding the schedule, so if a caregiver does not clock in when they're scheduled to start service delivery, then the EVV system will generate alerts at 15 and 30 minute intervals. If there is something in effect taken as a result of those alerts, then those alerts will stop. But the first alert will be escalated to the provider agency, to the person who helps with service coordination. And then if there is a second alert generated, then that'll be generated to their supervisor to make sure that the provider agency is aware they need to take action. As part of the tracking in the EVV system, we'll be able to track reasons visits did not occur as scheduled, and we'll also be able to track whether or not the contingency plan was utilized. And again, this will help inform larger efforts around us identifying potential network adequacy issues or whether or not we have workforce development challenges that may result in some of these events. In a more general sense, we're also using EVV to support workforce development planning. So there's some basic information in the EVV system when a caregiver is entered into the system, such as their hire and end dates of employment. And we will be utilizing that data to help track retention, including also information about how many DCWs are only serving one member. That helps inform our workforce development planning as to relates to the total pool of caregivers that are available to serve our members. We'll also be able to look at those caregivers that are providing services through multiple agencies. And then we'll also be able to track if a caregiver has is leaving one agency to go work for another, meaning they're staying in the workforce development pool, if you will, in the industry, or whether or not somebody has left entirely and left and gone out of the industry. So that's also helping our workforce development planning efforts, which also helps ensure network adequacy and access to care for our members. And that includes my portion of the EVV presentation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Arizona. Those were all three great presentations. It was amazing to hear about some of the initiatives that you've taken. And while we do have time for a question and answer, there is a chat box. That's the best way to go about putting a question in to Christina. But while she gathers those, I do have a couple of questions if we want to just kind of start and go through the presentation. And I'll start on the value-based payment side. Matthew? There we go. I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of the genesis for some of these initiatives. This is always an interesting thing for states because sometimes this comes via federal mandate. Sometimes you have a very enterprising, interested legislator. Sometimes it's a staff person or a Medicaid director. And that always shapes the process, right, as to how states develop specific initiatives and programs. So particularly around value-based payment, can you just talk a little bit about the process to developing your quality performance measures and kind of how you arrived at what those would look like?
Sure. In this case, it was really a self-directed sort of initiatives from the agency director. I think that we took some of our bearings from the federal guidance that was released under the managed care regs that provided the sort of regulatory framework that we were able to operate within and indicated that there was some level of understanding and support at the CMS perspective. In terms of the APM WANG continuum and those sorts of initiatives, I think that we've tried to take our bearings from some of the national organizations that have been putting out those best practices. In terms of the differential adjust payments in particular, I think that those have really developed organically in the agency over the course of the past 4 or 5 years. They started with really, you know, a limited subset of providers, and it did start with the health information exchanges and really trying to push forward on that. And I think since we've been able to implement that model successfully in a number of different ways, it's something that we've been able to continue to leverage and to really expand the size of the program year after year. I think a really critical aspect of the differential adjusted payment strategies in particular has been stakeholder engagement. So over the past couple of years, our agency has used a request for information or RFI process to really explicitly engage with stakeholders, so ranging from health plans to providers, to provider advocacy groups, and to member advocacy groups to really incorporate their feedback. Especially on quality measures, our goal and really the CMS requirement has been to tie these explicitly back to the goals and objectives that are included in the agency's quality strategy.
Fantastic. That's really helpful. And I think it's great always to see like states taking those enterprising steps. You know, value-based payment has kind of been the buzz phrase for us for quite some time now. So good work. Moving on to the rideshare portion of the presentation, Christina, are you able to respond?
Yeah.
Okay, making sure. And kind of a similar question, I have a couple, but as far as the rideshare movement in Medicaid, this is something that we're seeing kind of pop up in various states, but really Arizona was among the first movers. So what was it that brought about this approach for your Medicaid members? Was it really, you know, you referenced kind of that there was the opioid use disorder crisis that really is driving a lot of the need for transportation services and addressing social determinants of health in states, but kind of what brought you to this conclusion?
I think it was just we looked at, you know, overall utilization patterns and capacity of the current providers and thought this was a good opening to provide this additional option for NEMT utilization.
Mm-hmm. And was there... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Matthew.
Yeah, I think another factor that has given us some flexibility to move on some of these is being very heavily managed care and being able to to push out a model and see how the market responds. I think Arizona has a good amount of Arizona Medicaid has a good amount of support from our governor and the governor's office. For these sorts of solutions that are trying to initiate those public-private partnerships in a pretty business-friendly sort of environment, and this was a real immediate opportunity that we saw to partner with those large market players.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of those partnerships, how did you all negotiate that lower reimbursement rate? I imagine that there was a lot of back and forth with private industry on that.
Yeah, so actually on the lower reimbursement rate, so the agency put that out as a public notice, and we received some limited feedback. I think we are in a unique situation in that in this case, you know, our agency our agency prepared and completed a financial review that resulted in the rates that were described. But ultimately, since this is really being implemented through managed care, it's our managed care organizations who are sitting down at the table with industry and are negotiating those contracted rates. And they usually do that with reference to our fee schedule, and in this case, the adjusted fee schedule. But I think the unique opportunity for the managed care organizations was that since the rates that we had come out with is kind of the benchmark, the starting point, if you will, since those were lower than what they had already been paying for similar services, it allowed a chance for the MCOs to negotiate some savings from what they were otherwise funded for in the capitation rates. And really allowed the state to not need to directly engage in those negotiations. Our role in this case is really more to set the framework and to set some benchmarks and allow the providers and the MCOs to come to terms.
Yeah, that makes sense. And kind of to follow up on that a little bit further in talking about the rural populations, I know that one of the things that we've heard from states is that in rural areas, it's difficult to find contracted drivers, that there just isn't, like when we talk about that as a network, that's not as robust in rural areas. So did you all have any challenges in that?
So again, you know, given that the majority of our population is managed care, that falls to the health plans to determine the best available provider and to ensure there's a network of providers available to provide services. So whether that's through the rideshare provider type or through the standard NEMT provider type, they would be the ones that would determine, you know, of course we require them to have a sufficient network, but as for the specifics of what providers are in their network and the availability of providers, that would be on the MCOs to obtain those contracts.
And from a rates and reimbursement perspective, there is in our fee schedule a rural modifier. So structurally, there's enhanced reimbursement for transportation in rural areas in order to try to respond to that need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. And it sounds like between the work that you all did and the work that your MCOs are doing, you're able to address those things. That's very cool. I'm so impressed with these kind of innovative rideshare models that we're seeing across states. It's great. And then, Dara, finally, to get to that last part of the presentation, actually your very last slide, something that virtually every state is addressing in one way or another, is the workforce needs. As we kind of discussed at the very beginning of the presentation, we have a rapidly growing aging population. And it's kind of been a part of the cultural milieu for quite some time that we don't necessarily have the workforce to be able to care for that population. So you referenced a little bit that as you're kind of capturing this data, that's going to help to inform where you start initiating kind of workforce programs in the future. Do you have any ideas of what that might look like as you start to get that data back down the line?
So we currently have a requirement for each of our MCOs to have a workforce development administrator, and they develop similar, it's actually part of the network adequacy plans, where they submit a annual plan as to how they're going to, one, understand the workforce shortages, whether it's specific to home and community-based services or other provider types and services. And what kinds of strategies are they going to use to address those shortages or potentially mitigate shortages that they anticipate having? So that work is already currently underway. So some of our MCOs are doing, some of the times they do things jointly together if it makes sense and it spans across providers that are contracted with by multiple health plans. And they're still currently in a data gathering stage, but some health plans are doing really innovative things around, you know, going to high schools and participating in high school career fairs to promote the field of direct care support. We also, at the Access level, have a workforce, for our long-term care program, have a workforce development advisory committee, which is inclusive of provider industry leaders, as well as the health plans, as well as folks from our universities, folks from our Department of Education. They recently created a career and technical education program for direct care workers, so high school students are being trained as direct care workers before they actually leave high school, so that they can have a job while they're going to college, for example. So there's lots of innovative stuff that's already happening. We just look at EVV as being another data element to be able to track this. And this is also a way to track it without the providers having to do anything extra, you know, having to supplement with additional data to be able to sort of track some of these utilization patterns.
Yeah, absolutely. And anything that you can do to kind of make that easier and more efficient on their end is obviously good. But it sounds like you're doing some great work in the workforce development arena. I know that all states are interested in doing that, and anything that we can do to be working with emerging providers is a good thing, right?
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. It looks like we have one more question popping up. All right, and you all can take this, all three of you can answer or one of you can answer, however you want to approach it. How do state policymakers prioritize this issue, given everything else that is going on, especially across state agencies?
Are you asking about these specific initiatives, or are you asking specifically about serving elderly persons in rural Arizona?
So I'm going to guess that the person who asked this question meant the latter.
So I think from a financial perspective that we have a lot of awareness that the demographic trends that were mentioned early on in the presentation, that those are coming and are going to be cumulative impacts that really hit the state budget over time. I think also since Arizona has some pretty established long-term care programs, that there are significant dollars that the state has invested in those programs that have been operating very efficiently. So for example, our state has been successful in really shifting the balance from the majority of our members in the LTSS programs in a nursing facility setting to the majority of the members in an HCBS setting. So I think our current average is 76% in HCBS settings. So I think being able to build that fiscal case, that financial case, and look at the state budget impacts, the real cost of not investing in these initiatives is an erosion of our HCBS system that is ultimately going to be more costly for the state in the long run, and also going to provide lower quality outcomes for our most vulnerable members.
And with respect to EVV, I think we just took something we were already mandated to do and figured out what potential configurations we could make in the system to also make it an access to care initiative. So it kind of was just like a no-brainer for us from that perspective. It is something different that we're doing than other states, so it's taking some configuration and time to really map out what this all looks like. But for us, it just was something we were already required to invest in, so we just looked at other ways we could capitalize on that investment to address some of these other issues.
Absolutely. And I think that you know, you kind of hit the nail on the head there, Matthew, with the one thing that states are always thinking about is saving your, it's the things that don't cost you down the line, right? It's taking the initiative now in order to not cost yourself in the future. It's a way to save money almost in a preventative way. Are there any other questions coming up in the chat, Christina, or are we at the end of the question portion?
No other questions have come in so far.
Okay, thanks, Christina. This has been a fantastic presentation. I thank you again, Arizona, for all of the information that you presented. Lots of really great initiatives to help rural adults who are aging in place. Again, we do have a toolkit that NASHBE put together that looks at a multitude of states and their various initiatives. Lots of little interesting kind of policy levers that have been pushed and ways to move forward with this population are presented in that toolkit that's posted on the NASHBE website. You'll be able to access both that toolkit as well as these slides from the website. However, you will also get an email that has a link to these slides that you can access that way as well. Am I missing any other access points, Christina?
Nope, you've got it, Jody.
All right, fantastic. That leaves us with 9 minutes that I can give back to you. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Feel free to reach out with any questions. Take care.